meeting you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. So here's three other guys here tonight who are involved with the SickNet as co-net control people, as we call them. John KC2WGB, who also handles the mailbag. Paul WS2N is our space expert. And Hal K6DPZ, who for the first 50 minutes of the net is teaching me how to give more brief answers. The TechNet, as you guys have heard Sir Don many times, is a gathering of the clan in which amateurs from the tri-state area, which this repeater has pretty good coverage of, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, most of Long Island, particularly with the east and west repeater on Long Island, we've got pretty good coverage of Long Island, and in that tri-state metropolitan New York City area, there's a lot of brain power that we try to tap into. Let me drop. In other words, when a particular subject is being discussed, hopefully somebody in that area, or also the outer areas like Canada and other places where by way of Echolink and IRLP, they also have connection to us. If they've got experience in a particular area, they chime in and let us know the benefit of their particular experience. The TechNet is not always interesting. Some nights are boring. Some nights are a lot less than boring. The difference is the questions you guys ask. That's really the main schedule, so to speak. What do you guys ask? The nights where it's more boring, it's where somebody didn't ask the questions that you happen not to like. Everybody is welcome to sign into the TechNet. You don't have to be a LIMARC member. About the only thing you really have to have is a PL tone 136.5, or the so-called 4Z PL. That is required. Otherwise, I'll hear you on the input, because I listen to the input frequency when somebody is talking, but the machine will not repeat you if you don't have a PL tone. That's the main requirement you got to have. Let me drop. The TechNet has been around for 30 years. At the end of this month, it will be the 31st year. And it's already won, the TechNet has already won some nice ARRL awards and LIMARC awards, because there are people who think it serves a particular purpose. There's an awful big thirst for knowledge on radio and wireless equipment. By my standards, most of the so-called really good schools in the United States do a fairly mediocre job of teaching wireless. And the best example I can think of it is a guy can graduate summa cum laude with a real good school, master's degree, bachelor degree, and you'll suddenly discover that he had essentially zero instruction on how to design, build, and troubleshoot an antenna. And it's really crazy, because as you've heard me say so often, you can have a gold-plated transmitter and a perfect receiver, and if you don't connect it to an antenna, you've got nothing. You could say that the real wireless communication starts off with a good antenna design, and then you hang some electronics on it. It's not the other way around. And that so-called fields and waves course, or the Maxwell's equation course, half of all the engineers I interview will tell me that's the course they hated the most. It's the one that they waited until it went away. They suffered through it. It seemed to give them no useful engineering information in the way it's taught. And it's been taught traditionally that way since roughly 1947, with essentially no change. By comparison, let me drop. By comparison, you go to a school that teaches computer science, and that course is changed every single semester in order to keep it current. There are 20 kinds of wireless products in the world, something like 6 billion cell phones being used. There's a lot of wireless equipment. Everybody wants everything to be wireless, the keyboard, the display, the cordless phone, the remote control for the garage door, whatever, lots and lots of products. They all need wireless knowledge. And so you really want somebody with wireless knowledge, most likely you're going to hire a ham radio operator. When we take in check-ins, I'm going to tell you now what is the schedule, how do we run the actual TechNet. Most of you guys already know this, but for the new people that join us, let me drop. Our schedule is that for the first hour or so, we take check-ins and we make a virtual promise that you'll get an answer within the first hour, a slightly brief answer within the first hour. For the people who check in with a question or a comment, you need not check in to say you're listening. After 30 years of TechNet, a few thousand hours of it. By now, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. After the first hour, John opens the mailbag. John is KC2WGB, and for the people who send him messages by carrier pigeon, snail mail, internet, whatever, for the people who don't yet have a ham license or don't yet have the equipment by which they can talk to us live, they give us a question, and John chooses a few of those that he thinks has general interest. Let me drop. And you'll be kind of amazed at some of those budding guys, new amateur radio operators, I can tell are real good scientists by the kind of questions they ask. After John gives us two, three, or four mailbag submittals, and we go through those, Paul, our space expert, WS2N, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing lately. And there's an amazing number of people who listen to the TechNet just to hear that. They want to know what NASA is doing when interpreted by somebody who can put it into real English. And John's, Paul's pretty good at that. Throughout the TechNet, from time to time, Hal, K6WPZ, K6W, why am I having trouble with his call letters? Delta Papa Zulu, yes. He'll give us examples of what a briefer answer should sound like. After that, starting at approximately 10 o'clock or so, we go into deeper subjects. Not always is everybody pleased with the deeper subjects. Be forewarned that that's going to take place, and if that displeases you, be ready to turn your receiver off at that time or tune to another one of the 800 channels you've got on the 2-meter band alone. Okay, that gives you the schedule. A person's going to sign in by giving me and John and Paul and Hal, give us your call letters and your name. Call letters and name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So check in if you've got a question or a comment for the benefit of the net or because you want to know it, not because you're listening. That's not required. Please give me your call letters and name right now. KQLIW listening.
Susan, Tulio saying hello, Dick.
Yes.
Very fine, Rich. I think the person who then said yes was it sounded like the voice of Joe, W2LYY. Is that true, Joe?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, you didn't come through the machine, Joe, but I heard you on the input. So we got Joe and Rich. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
NY2HF, Dennis, yes.
Okay, the man from the North Fork, way out there. We got you, Dennis. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Mr. BBN, Freddy. One of these days, if he hasn't already done so, I know Barry's going to be visiting you and making improvements in your system there in Far Rockaway. Anyone else to check into the TechNet tonight because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now.
That's to Ann Paul. Space report. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John.
For the short answers.
I know that Hal is there, and I got you, Paul. I heard somebody, which I think is tricking in by Echolink or whatever, named Lance. Lance, please give me your call letters and name. Give me your call letters one more time, Lance.
Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel, Lance, Reno, Nevada.
Very fine, Reno. KF7. Victor November Foxtrot. We got you, Lance, and you're one of the longest distance guys that have checked in a long time. Okay, one more call. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW. We have more than enough to get going. The first person with a real question was Joe, the B2LYY. And how's the world of wireless radio treating you, Joe? The B2LYY, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Firstly, am I coming through the repeater now? I don't think I've had a problem with radio. Can you hear me through the repeater?
As they used to say in the old days, that's a big 10-4, good buddy. Yes, you're coming through the repeater very well. on the previous transmission where I heard you on the input, I believe the machine had timed out. And let me remind everyone that in between each transmission, there is a four-beep sequence. Wait and listen to all four beeps before you make your transmission. Without that, the whole network of Echo Link, IRLP, repeaters, and whatever, and linking to the repeaters, all of that system doesn't get properly reset, and we time it out if you don't first listen for all four beeps. They're coming through fine, Joe, so go right ahead. W2LYY, KQRIW.
Okay, hi there. Good evening, Dick. I had an electronics enthusiast, actually a former ham, ask me a question the other day, and I didn't know how to really answer this. I wasn't quite sure, and this is probably right at the rally. When power companies buy power from other power sources, wherever they may be, I understand there's different, you know, voltages and stuff like levels that come in, or maybe they're on the same, you know, primary power at these places. But how do these companies get in sync with each other so they're in phase when they join their power and you're buying power from somebody else? Now, how is that power fed in phase to this system, like, say, locally here, so it doesn't do any damage to the equipment? Back to you.
I wish the answer was that by way of National Bureau of Standards and their precision timing code, that they can all lock up to the exact same reference oscillator, count down from that oscillator in order to generate the 60 hertz, and everybody would be in phase. That's a nice, simple sounding answer. Not at all. There's a lot more going on. Let me show you. Let's assume you've got a power company in Michigan, and you've got a power company in Long Island, and they're both connected to the grid. And just for simple reasons, let's assume that they're both are the only two that are on the grid. There's a grid of just two power companies, one in Michigan and one on Long Island. And round off the numbers, let's assume there's 1,000 miles between the two. 1,000 miles is a millisecond. 60 hertz is something like 60 milliseconds per cycle. So if Michigan is supplying most of the power, where they're the source and Long Island is the load, because of the 1,000 miles of difference in the millisecond of delay, what you think is proper phasing would be a signal coming from Michigan getting to Long Island is going to be delayed in time, and therefore the power company on Long Island to sync up with them would be lagging in phase by some number of degrees. I'm going to round it off. Let's assume it's a 30-degree delay. So in order for everything to be synced up, Long Island would be generating power 30 degrees later in 60-cycle sine wave compared to Michigan. If Michigan was the main source and Long Island is making a minor contribution, Long Island would be delayed. If tomorrow Long Island is doing most of the generating and Michigan is the load, it would be the other way around. Now Long Island would be 30 degrees advanced compared to Michigan. This is one of the things that I've never seen discussed.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So who is doing most of the generating and who is doing most of the loading? That alone shifts the phase. I'm reasonably sure that a power company, let's assume that the grid's been running now for the last umpty-ump days, and you've just turned on your generator in Glenwood Landing, Long Island, because you're part of the LIPA, Long Island Power Authority. You just brought up your generator up to speed, and now you're looking at the grid, you're looking at the phase of your generator, and you're going to do whatever adjustment is required before you close the switch. If, for instance, the Glenwood Landing Power Station was exactly 180 degrees out of phase compared to the grid, and you close the switch between the two, all hell would break loose. That's essentially a dead short circuit. The grid's putting out positive voltage at the instant you're generating negative voltage. And boy, you're going to get smoke and flames when you do that. So I'm guaranteeing that they very carefully look at the phase of their generator on Long Island versus the grid before they close the switch. The next question people usually ask, let me drop.
Thank you. The comments on that one, Dick?
Your comments also.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to Glenn and I'm going to go over to Glenn and Hal in that order. The next thing people usually ask is, how do you decide how to charge the individual companies? If, for instance, a Loyon has excess generating capacity compared to the rest of the grid, how do they make sure the power flows out of Long Island into the grid instead of the other way around? Common sense would might lead you to believe that Long Island would advance or retard the phase in order to supply or sink. It's not phase. It's amplitude. You set the field of your particular generator so it generates slightly higher voltage. It's probably only a few millivolts or microvolts higher. But you set the generator on Long Island slightly higher, and it's going to be supplying power to the grid, as opposed to if you set the generator a little bit lower. If all of Long Island is a few millivolts lower than the grid, then most of the rest of the grid will be supplying power to Long Island. By measuring the direction of current flow and the magnitude of voltages, you can now figure out in which direction is the power flowing and how much and who's supplying and who's sinking. And good old 60-cycle power generation, which to the average ham radio operator is about as low a frequency as you ever want to consider. Let me drop. As you can tell, there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Now, Glenn, KC2QIQ, has generated, he has personally designed various circuits that do power management, power cleanliness. I can't think of the name of the darn thing, but there's a kind of a circuit that'll take a transistorized inverter that you're locally using and making sure that it's generating clean power. There's also circuits that'll make sure that the phase angle is being properly adjusted. If you're running a factory where you're using megawatts of power during the day, you have to make sure that the phase angle of your load is a pure resistor. If your factory looks inductive because you're running a whole lot of punch presses, a whole lot of rotary machines, where you make a great big inductive load, you have therefore a significant power factor, that's the word they use for it, well, your power company is going to charge you a premium because of that power factor if you don't correct it. So give us some words on all of this, Glenn, because I know you've been in that field for quite a few years. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick, and good evening. Yeah, power generation is kind of interesting. It's a mystery to a lot of people, but it's a very, very simple system. The AC power system that we use at 60 cycles is actually a much simpler system than a lot of people would think. Everybody thinks that it's like fine electronics, and that you know, if you interconnect things the wrong way, that you're going to have smoke and things going to explode. Actually, quite the contrary. It's a very robust system. And when generators are attached in phase, the thing that you have to remember is that parallel circuits are always in phase. So the minute you close the switch, regardless of the phase position of your generator, they become instantly in phase at the moment of the switch closure. Let me let it drop.
I'm going to challenge you on that one. If it's your own local solid-state generator, I agree with you, Glenn. But if you've got this massive rotary machine in Glenwood Landing, and if it happens to be generating now 180 degrees out of phase when you close that switch, my goodness, you're going to do damage. Wait for the beeps, which I didn't do. Over to you, Glenn.
Hey, you should let me finish, Dick, but it's quite the contrary. It really doesn't. It actually doesn't do any damage at all. What does happen is you're correct about one thing. When you have the field winding on a generator, that when you push the voltage up on the generator, that yes, it becomes more of the source, and when you lower the voltage or the lower the field winding current, basically yes, then the current will be lower. In other words, you won't be putting as much power into the grid, but you have to be careful with that field winding because that's what's going to determine whether your generator could even start looking like a load. But that's another story. I don't want to get too involved in that for now because it's much more complexity to this problem than there really is. If you were to take a large generating station, and the minute you close that switch contactor, it's instantly in phase, regardless of the position of the electromagnets or anything else. They will basically eventually catch up, so that they'll always track to whatever the matching phase. That is the synchronization. It's just closing the switch. And realistically, when you close it, you're so worried that the voltage is at a different level. The minute you close that switch, they are at the same level. It's just a matter of now. The only difference is current. Is the current going into the source or out of the source? So if you're out of phase, you'll be generating more current. But it's in so few cycles that it eventually catches up, so that eventually the loading becomes even. So when you first look at the amount of loading over a power line cable, the power lines, when you're looking at miles and miles of wire and transformers and everything else in between, the generator will only generate a certain amount of current, and it stops anyway. So it's just the maximum amount of current that the generator can put out. If it's 100,000 amperes, it's just 100,000 amperes. And people are like, wow, those sound like large numbers, but to the grid, that's just a bag of peanuts. It's nothing. KC2, QIQ.
WH1YY, I have two questions directly related to this subject.
I hear you, Joe. And Glenn, I'm reasonably sure I somewhat disagree with what you said. I can give some examples that make me think there's a little bit more to it. But I know Hal wants to give us the brief answer on this one that's going to straighten it all out in a couple of sentences. And here's Hal giving us that example. K6TPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
K6TPZ. Well, remember, you have two generators, and you want a phase of number. Well, it depends how many phases the generator is putting out. Let's say a single-phase generator AC. If you vary the speed of one of the generators, and between both the generators you use some current device like a light bulb, you can monitor, and when the light bulb dips in its brilliance, the speed of both generators then will be the same, and then you can hit the switch. That's my only comment on that. Go ahead, KTIWK6DPZ. Speed of the generator will also govern the phase.
In the power generating course that I took at Pratt Institute, where they had a bunch of rotary machines, pretty massive rotary machines, in a mechanical engineering laboratory on the second floor of the engineering building. That's exactly what they did, Hal. They had a, was it 110 or a 240 volt light bulb between the generator, between the two separate generators, where they hadn't yet been connected together. And sure enough, when you get them synced up in the right speed, the light bulb stops blinking, and when you get them at the right phase, the bulb will go to minimum dimness, and you can also put in a real voltmeter there to get it more exact than just looking at the light of a light bulb. But I remember the instructor, giving us an example of making sure the light bulb goes out before you close the switch. He did an example of not doing that. He didn't have the light bulb at maximum brilliance. He had it at about 20% brilliance. And he closed the switch when they were out of phase. And you would listen to that loud arcing and sparking of the commutator portion of those generators. And you listen to the groaning of those machines. And you realize that if you close the switch when they're not synchronized, and these are just two small generators, 3 foot in diameter type machines, and when you're using a really big, huge rotary machine with a turbine that's as tall as your house, and you get the rotary kinetic energy of that machine, if that's out of phase when you close the switch, my goodness, you're going to get smoke and flames, is my belief. I know that Glenn feels differently on that. You're going to hear both sides of the story. Guaranteed there's a lot more to it. Now, Joe's going to modify the question a little bit. Go right ahead, Joe. It's a good one. W2RYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQ2QIQ with more on that one, Vic, because remember, I've got a lot of experience in this area, and especially in power distribution. Would you want me to continue?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let me get my two cents here because it'll add to your conversation, okay?
Yeah, stand by, Glenn. I listened to those machines grinding themselves up. And so with the experience I personally have seen, I'm having some trouble accepting what you've said so far. We're going to go back to you in a little bit, Glenn. Let's hear what Joe... Joe's the guy who asked the original question, so he's allowed to modify it then, or add to it. To B2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I would guess these generators are multi-winding type of generators. However, they're putting out where you vary the speed of the thing by maybe tenths of an RPM, you're going to start seriously affecting the phase. So I wasn't sure how you'd correct the phase, but that sounds like a very viable way to do it. Increase or decrease the speed to match the phase of where you're coming from. And being distributed over, 1,000 miles span, that's another whole trick by itself. I'm not sure if they use any other kind of fine electronics. But one thing you did say, about millivolts or microvolts of power being more or less would make you a source or a load, all right? take that thought and bring that back to somebody's home system in their house. For them to supply power into the grid, which has an extremely low impedance if you want to look at it like that, they have to put out sort of amount of voltage that's like extremely small and higher compared to what they're seeing coming in. Doesn't that put a tremendous amount of stress on the house equipment? Because I don't understand what you're saying, but I'm just trying to think of the whole thing through point to point, that you're supplying a tremendous load when you do that to make your power flow backwards into the grid. You follow what I'm saying, Dick?
NY2HF would comment.
Dennis recognized, and you're behind Glenn's comment. Let me let the machine reset. To partially answer your question, Joe, you can make believe that that grid that's out there, the rest of the world, there are various means by which you could measure its apparent impedance from your house. And assuming that your wiring is in good shape, and you've got 200 amp service, and you look back into that grid, and you run your machinery that can measure the impedance of that as a source. I didn't say it's easy, but it can be done. And I am guessing when you did that, you'll find out that the apparent source impedance is some small number of micro-ohms. In other words, from your point of view, that grid is the stiffest single generator you're ever going to see. You can go from 0 to 200 amperes of load in a millisecond, and you watch on your oscilloscope how much their voltage changes when you do that, and you're going to have trouble resolving it because it's near some small number of micro-ohms is my guess. The generator in your house, because you're running solar panels, wind generators, or whatever, probably has a source of impedance. I'm going to pick a number of an ohm. Compared to a micro-ohm, they dominate. Whatever voltage is going to be on that line, they generate that voltage, and you can't change it. However, with your one ohm of impedance, if you, I'm just using an example now, let me drop. Assume that your particular signal generator, your alternator, whether it be solid state, rotary, or whatever, it's being fed by your solar panel or your windmill or your tide machine or whatever you've got, your hydroelectric generator in your backyard if you happen to have a river nearby, whatever is generating your power. Let's assume that your machine has a source impedance of one ohm, and they're micro-ohms, and you'd like to supply an ampere of current from them to you. If you set your open circuit voltage 1 volt higher than they are, let's assume that they're generating at 120 volts RMS, and you make your open circuit voltage 121 volts, 1 volt higher, and you've got one ohm of source impedance, then in that simplistic example, 1 ampere will flow from you to them. You're supplying 120 volts, 1 ampere's worth. You're going to be supplying 120 watts into them in my simplistic example. There's a lot more to the story, and Glenn's going to make it a little bit more clear for us right now. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's a good thing you guys have a power engineer around here tonight. So the question that you're asking is called drip theory. Dick, am I making a machine right now?
You sound quite good. Make sure you don't eat the mic, and you're in good shape. Glenn, go ahead.
Okay. Dick is describing is called drip theory. In other words, if you have two sources and you have a load line in between, in other words, some kind of a feed line, there's some basic resistance to that feed line, whether it's 1 ohm, 1/10 of an ohm, 1 micro-ohm, there's some difference of impedance between the connection between the two generators. So the one that has a slightly higher voltage, whatever the voltage drop is across the feed line difference between the two generators, is going to create a voltage drop and a current in that direction. So that's called droop regulation or droop sharing. So if you have two generators, whatever impedance is connecting the two and whatever the voltage difference is, one generator will start to feed the other. So that's basically how that one works. Let me see if that makes sense first, then I'll go back to power generation and sharing again. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think that does, Glenn. And by the way, every one of us is using the word generator. And yes, our machine, whether it be electronic or mechanical, it generates voltage and it generates power and it's capable of supplying it. However, as a block diagram, you can call it generator. 99% of the time, it is an alternator. By that I mean the so-called field winding with the great big heavy leads, usually one or three phases of it. That's what's really going to the outside world. And the rotary magnetic field in the middle of that rotary machine of yours, it's got some slip rings on it, and but that combination, a field that rotates in the middle of a set of windings, and the windings themselves have no commutation. That kind of a machine is an alternator. 99% of the things in your car are alternator. I think 99% of the power generating... I think 99% of the power generating things at our power stations are also alternators. So to be a little bit more exact, every time you hear the word generator, it really is alternator. But go ahead with the rest of your thought, Glenn. I'm still worried because I personally heard all of that sparking and groaning when just two relatively small machines, as so-called generators, but they're really alternators. Oh, those were generators. They had real commutators to them, but that's a rather minor factor. Boy, did they groan and spark if you connected them out of phase. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, the experiment you probably did in Pratt Institute is really not representative of the power system and how it really works. Basically, what's happening is if you look at a power generation station, there are no switches per se. If you look at the actual wiring from the main generators themselves going directly out to the substations, and there was the substations, the first part of usually what they have, the 135 kW grid that everything originally starts going on. That's the main power line grid. There are no switches generally in that area. But what happens is in the generator itself, there's a field winding, and the field winding controls the amount of current that the generator puts out. Do you understand me on that one so far, Dick?
There's a yes and a no to that one, Glenn. If I first measured what's coming out of the so-called generator, which is really an alternator, before I closed the switch, if there was a switch, I'm measuring open circuit voltage. And as I make the field current into the field, which is generating the amount of magnetic field, as I increase or decrease the magnetic field, that changes the voltage that's generated. Now, if my generator happens to have a 7 impedance of 1 ohm, and if I set that voltage one volt higher before I connect to the grid, then yes, I'm generating 1 ampere, and from then on, when it's generating, it appears as though the current goes up and down, and the direction of the current goes left and right, as I make that field current go up and down. So you'll watch the meters go up and down in current as they adjust the amount of magnetic field by adjusting its current. But in reality, it's adjusting the open circuit voltage, and whichever one is higher determines which way the current flows. So are we adjusting the voltage or are we adjusting the current? And the answer is yes. That's my opinion. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, let's take a step backwards again. Remember what I said, there's no switches on the main power grid. If you're starting up a generator, let's say the generator is directly stopped, which does happen occasionally. Sometimes they have to be stopped for maintenance and other reasons that they have to be taken off-grid. But when you say off-grid, you do realize that they're not disconnected. They're still connected, even though they're off-grid. Do you follow me on this one? Unless, of course, it has to be mechanically disconnected. But there's a reason because of the voltages that many times they're not, the generators themselves are never physically disconnected. It's actually safety and other reasons that when the generators are actually, they're wired in up to the grid, they're wired and there's no other switches in between. Do you follow that one?
To a degree I do, and I've got a problem with it, Glenn. Let's assume that my alternator at Glenwood Landing is continuously connected to the grid. Ordinarily, the rotary field is rotating at just the right RPM, so I'm generating 60 cycles, three-phase power, everything's hunky-dory. If I leave my alternator continuously connected, and I allow the rotary portion, the rotating field, to stop moving, at the instant it stops, there's a huge voltage at a 60-cycle rate coming out of that winding, and that winding better be open circuited, otherwise a lot of current's going to be flowing through it, and it's going to burn itself up. So if I could open circuit the field winding, and you're going to be generating a great big voltage if I leave it continuously connected to the grid, because now it's a transformer being fed backwards. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now you're getting on target again. It's basically it. That's really what you're looking at, is the winding inside that generator is like a backwards winding transformer that's on the other end with a field winding that's being controlled on the other side. So the field control is actually, there's actually two major steps to starting up a large power generator. One is the motor speed control, and the other control is the field control, which is the amplitude output. So those are the two main things. But basically what's happening is on startup or off during service, the field winding is wide open. That's exactly how it starts until the motor is started. Then what happens is once you get the motor up to speed, you slowly bring the field winding into a higher current state. But because realistically how they determine whether you're feeding the grid or not feeding the grid is they have to synchronize and measure the voltage, because the grid is always at the correct phase of voltage. In other words, if you're always measuring the voltage on the grid, that is the correct phase. So once the motor comes up to speed, you basically just synchronize the speed or the frequency that you're looking at of the grid, and then you bring the field winding in to adjust the current and the loading on the generator. Does that make more sense, Dick? KC2QIQ.
To a degree. In other words, if I've now got fancy electronics connected to that field winding, and if the field rotating rate from its turbine is a little bit slow, a little bit low in RPM, I'm going to be generating a very large AC voltage on that winding. If my electronics can follow that voltage and change its amplitude and phase and whatever by the way you drive it, I think you're telling me that even though my machine is turning at slightly wrong in RPM, by way of the AC voltage that I'm applying to that field winding, I can make it synchronize with the rest of the grid even before I bring the machine up to exactly the right RPM and the right phase angle. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
Dick, that's exactly how it works. Because if you look at that, that's how it's done on the generator side, or the alternator, as you're saying, in this particular case. But what's really happening is when you look out in the field, how this whole thing is really working is when the loads are actually being attached and the grid is actually being serviced in between, it's being done by linemen. Linemen aren't looking at the grid. They're looking at a hunk of wire and a big pair of insulated gloves. And when they're attaching different parts of the grid and the distribution, they're just hard attaching it. When that load gets attached, bang. So they have to make sure that when those linemen electricians are making those connections out there in the field, that they have big enough wire, big enough transformer, and large enough insulating gloves so that when they make those things in poles, when they make those attachments to that power, and it comes online, those are big hits. Because remember, this is a big boy system. This isn't little generators in a lab where you hear a little bit of a little moaning from a little generator. This is all serious stuff out in the field. And when those connections are made, they're hard connections. There's no real, monitoring out in the field. Go ask a lineman. KC2QIQ.
And if you and I could set up our local power generating station, the QIQ-RIW power station, to have no real switches on that main output winding of this alternator, there's a lot of advantages we can do it that way. I can see some of what you're talking about. Although, if the rotating rate of our alternator, if the mechanical portion of its armature is rotating at the wrong rate, then the so-called field winding is not running a steady DC current and a steady amount of magnetic field. It's now an AC. If we're 1 RPM low in revolutions, then most likely there's going to be a great big voltage at a 1 Hertz rate that has to be accommodated on that field winding. And during the time that goes through zero, are you really alternating? Are you really supplying to the grid? I got a little bit of a problem on that one, because although one of the phases is going through zero, the other two don't go through zero, and if you're generating I know that Dennis wants to give us a couple of words, and I've been monitoring how well the coupling is taking place to the eastern input, the 147.375. I know you've had some dropouts, Dennis, and I know you've not heard the whole story. You may have to wait until you get to listening to the... let me drop. You may have to wait until you get to the website, so to speak. For those who ever want to listen to the last 7 years of TechNets, they're all recorded by this very enthusiastic guy, Mike Perry, KC2NJI. And if you go to his website at amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and download those one-hour reels, and you can listen to past TechNet. And so after a real live TechNet takes place, usually within a couple of days, sometimes it takes a week, depending on how busy Mike is, they get posted, if you know what I mean, and then you can listen to them. So, Dennis, I hope you got enough of the story during all those disconnects there to be able to give us your thoughts on this. NY2, Hotel Whiskey, the most eastern station out Long Island that I know of, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Sorry, Dennis. Question to Hotel Foxtrot. I heard enough of what was being said. There were some dropouts. I guess what I was going to add was that LIPA is so sloppy that it'd be hard trying to match up anything, whether it's a photovoltaic or a generator such as a turbine with windings. They're either under, over, they don't seem to really get it where they should. If you recall, I had 2 weeks where my solar panels on the roof didn't produce because LIPA was sending too much power down a grid that they shut them down. And the flip side has also happened where they're sending too little power down a grid and shuts the production of power down. So, you know, you have to look at the source. Trying to match something up.
Okay, you were coming through very well on the eastern machine. There was a little bit of a dropout at the end there. Some kind of a disconnect between the two machines, Dennis. Dennis, you're at the eastern extreme of Long Island, out on the North Fork of this fish-shaped island that we live on. As such, I know darn well that what you see in power, let me call it integrity, power purity, power fidelity, is going to be a little bit worse than the rest of us. And that's a given. You're on the hinterland. You're on the outer fringe of the connection of the system. However, there's something else funny going on. Let me drop. In the case of Superstorm Sandy, a significant number of people were out of power, had no power for 4 days, 10 days, 14 days, whatever. And for a person to sit there without power for that period of time and have to camp out in their own house where you don't have hot water, you don't have refrigeration, life gets pretty miserable. Thank goodness it occurred, it did occur in the wintertime. It occurred during a time when you really want to have heat and clean food and everything else. And so that makes people unhappy. And so various people said that, LIPA is really terrible. They got to be replaced. And they did a slipshod job of replacing everything. I've heard all kinds of people say that. And then I start questioning them. In the case of, let's say, Nassau, the heart of the system, and somebody says, boy, they did a sloppy job. I said, okay. If the telephone pole got broken by Hurricane Sandy, did they give you a new telephone pole? Yes. Was it brand new, in good shape, properly installed? Yes. If the transformer was blown out, did they give you a new transformer? Yes. If the wiring fell down, did they give you properly reconnected wire? Yes. Did the guy come along with the right kind of equipment to trim the trees and to correct all that? Yes. Okay. You said they did a sloppy job, they did a terrible job, but part of that job was bad. Each time I ask a person those questions, I usually do not get a coherent answer. The biggest thing that you can complain about is that when you call them on their advertised telephone number and you wanted to ask the question, how long will it be before my power is restored? A very logical question to ask. Let me drop. First of all, you did not get through. And if you did, if you're one of the very few people that did get through, you didn't get an answer. you didn't get an answer for a damn good reason. There was no answer. There was no answer because they imported a tremendous number of people to do the repairs, and now how can you best use those people? You can actually send them out there and to fix everything they find, and you try to direct them first to the heart of the system, the major hubs, so to speak, the major distribution stations, make sure they're up, make sure the hospitals are running, make sure the fire departments are running, make sure the ambulance services are running, and then you start fixing the individual private homes. But when it comes to how much of Long Island was out, I'm guessing 95%. You had approximately 1 million people on the island of Long without power. So do you start trying to figure out where the power is out? It's the other way around. Where's the power on? The power is only on for a couple of percent. And how long is it going to take to repair it? There was no human being on planet Earth that could give you that answer. If this was the best of all worlds, and you had a Vidicon camera on every single street corner, and you could remotely control that Vidicon camera, and you could look at the degree of damage at every one of those streets, and you enter it into a great big computer program, yes, under those circumstances, you could give a person an estimation as to how long. Or, correspondingly, you could have taken all of those remote resources that you imported. You imported a whole lot of people, and you could get them just walking up and down every street, writing down all of the errors that they see, and entering it into a great big computer program. You could spend the first week and a half just having all of your resources assess what is the damage without doing any repairs. That's going to make people unhappy. So if they're doing the repairs, they're not doing fast enough, you think they're not doing it well enough, and you have no answer as to when your power is going to be restored. Or if you stop and take the assessment of the system and you take a week or two doing that, that's not going to make people happy. No matter what the hell they did, people are going to be unhappy. And for the governor to sit up there and say that that's a terrible company, I'm going to replace them, and now some organization in New Jersey, which is roughly 200 miles away, is now going to be running Long Island, and it's going to be a whole lot better. I'm a little skeptical of that. So I'm not sure that we were mistreated on Long Island, but you out there on the eastern end, where to properly control all those lines that flow out there that far, and to give you voltage that's not too high, not too low, guarantee your frequency is right, Dennis, but for you to get the right voltage, it's a difficult problem. I believe you, because the number of miles between you and the heart of the system is near the maximum. You're out at the greater fringe. Now, what I've said just now, Dennis, is a whole bunch of opinions. I may be dead wrong, but let me pass it back to you for some comments on all of the above. NY2, Hotel Foxtrot, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Dennis.
I feel like a lobster, and to you with a question related to the subject, Dick.
You're on the list. Stand by, Rich. Go ahead, Dennis.
Thank you, Dick. First off, this had nothing to do with Sandy. Sandy was, an event that affected the whole of Long Island. What I'm talking about is normal course of the day. I'm talking about July last year when the voltages were spiking about, around 259, 263. They were going to the low spectrum at 244, 245, which was turning off the inverters for the solar power. I'm also talking about they blew out all of the GPS equipment at the local police department, because they pumped so much voltage down it that the alarms were going off, but they couldn't shut down fast enough. Lifer, I'm sorry. I'm not talking about trees, and I'm not talking about, they replaced the pole. I'm talking about the simple adjustment of what's coming down the grid is lacking. You know, they should be able to, maybe with computer assistance, to regulate and to get it to, where you're not underpowered when somebody turns on the air conditioner down a block or in the next county. So I have no faith in I welcome anybody new, because guess what? You know, it can't be as bad as it's been. I've had washing machines, circuit boards blow out. I've had dryers, circuit boards blow out. I've had double oven circuit boards blow out. I've got a refrigerator on the limp right now. You know, just lots of things. And, you know, it's the power coming in. It's the qualities, the regulation of the power. You know, you can put a line conditioner in, but, you know, there's certain things that you can't do that with, because it's going to skew the waveform. And, you know, you just got to let it be. So either the inverter shuts down for underpower, overpower, or lack of sunlight, you know, you're losing a lot of precious resource that you could probably be putting back into the grid, you know, to help the rest out and not have so much carbon loading. Back to you, Dick.
KC2QH, you with a comment?
Glenn's on the list right after Rich, but I've got a quick question for you, Dennis. You're one of those very green people that's generating power that you can plug back into the grid. You're one of those rare ones. First of all, just being a ham radio operator, you're one per 500 in the general population. Now, a ham radio operator who's got green, renewable energy resource capability at his house we can pump back into the grid. You're a pretty rare animal, Dennis. And my quickie question is, on a really good day, with perfect sunlight and everything working, perfect sunlight and everything working right, your inverter system, your solar-powered inverted system, is capable of generating how many watts, Dennis? NY2HF, KQRLAW in the TechNet.
KQ2HF.
My system is 30 panels. It's on a good day, it's probably about 42 kilowatt hours of power. That's not to mention that I'm about to build a solar batch collector for a hot water heater. That's not to mention that I have an inverter set up with about 20 deep cell batteries that I can run off the grid if I need to. That's not to say that I run a pellet stove in the winter instead of oil, and I'm going to add another pellet stove on the second floor so that I can do without the oil and just have it as a standby. I'm doing just about everything I can, including LEDs and fluorescence and everything else to make it so that LIPA goes out of business with my money.
Fantastic. My goodness, are you green. Being that green, you deserve to have a nice big radio tower in your backyard. And I have a sneaky suspicion something along those lines is coming. Eric, I know you might quite possibly have a point of order about the whole system, so go right ahead. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
At this point, just stand by for a minute, because I'm just going to reboot the whole thing. Just stand by for about a minute.
We're going to stand by for a minute. KQLIW.
I think you answered.
RC2N, repeater controller V5.52. The time is 8:55 p.m. The time is 8:55 p.m. Ready.
Okay, I just noticed that during those words that were being sent, nothing was sent out east, but right now east is very nicely connected. Yeah, I'm hearing the signal coming out of both west and east very well. I know that Rich was the next person who has a question on this particular subject, power generation. N2, Echo Oscar, a guy who's going to go home in a few days, KQRIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Rich.
K2LIW N2EO. Yeah, Dick, as far as power generation, you know, I just bought a house in Massapequa Park, Queens, which is Con Edison, is a lot more reliable, at least that's what I'm told. And it occurred to me long before Sandy or anything else, what about putting in Massapequa Park a backup system running off of, I don't know what running off, but you know, when I was in North Shore Hospital about a year ago, the whole Long Island went down due to a passing rolling storm. And you never know it because system in the hospital kicked in and kept everything running. So I was thinking of putting in something like that unless it's prohibitively expensive. Now, I can't do it myself because of this medical condition, but what do you think it would cost to hire a licensed electrician to put in something like that? Would it be prohibitively expensive, Dick? Back to you, and to Rio.
I don't have an exact answer for you, Rich, but I got a couple of ingredients I can tell you. And after Hurricane Super Sandy, on this particular TechNet, for the next month or so, we had a lot of discussions on the subject of power. And if you put it all together, this is what I think I heard. And that is, when you generate your own local power with some kind of a rotary machine, usually, whether it be gasoline-powered, liquid propane-powered, diesel-powered, whatever, you've got a huge decision to make. Do you want to live in the lamp of luxury, or do you want to live Spartan? You talk to Dave into APG, where he's got something in the vicinity of a 1,500-watt capability, and his machine would sip gasoline at about 1.5 gallons per day. Therefore, he did not stand on gas lines like other people did. His 1.5 kilowatts, as long as he plays power czar, he can decide to turn on his furnace. Maybe he can run the furnace with the refrigerator. Once the furnace stops running and the refrigerator is still running, he can turn on maybe the air conditioner. But he can turn on a whole bunch of other lights as long as he decides what is running when. 1.5 kilowatts for him in that neighborhood is enough. You take another guy who wants to make sure he can power everything because he has no control of his family. Everybody wants to turn on everything at once, and he adds it all up, and he's up to 15 kilowatts. Let me drop. So he goes out and buys a 15-kilowatt generator that goes to 8 gallons per day. And because he can't store that many gallons, every day and a half he's standing in line at the gas station to try to get gasoline. So the good news about buying a generator that's big enough, you can turn on everything. But then where's the gas going to come from? Or if you decide that, I'm only going to be without power once every 10 years for a couple of days, and for those couple of days, which might in some cases go to 14 days, that I don't have to live in the lamp of luxury. I can live in a Spartan environment in that time. As long as I've got hot water so I can take a shower, as long as I've got food that's not spoiling in the refrigerator, and I've got a furnace I can run so that the pipes are not freezing, and I've got to do a little bit of time sharing and all of that, that's good enough. So you have to, your biggest decision up front, is how big is that generator going to be? There's no exact answer. It's a function of you, and if you've got to have, maybe you're running an automatic breathing machine because you've got a person with a serious disability in your house, that's a very different environment. So there's a bunch of decisions you've got to make before you go out and start pricing it. And then once you do price it, there are hams that can do it for a very small number of dollars, or you can have it professionally done with a really big machine, but you can easily spend $30,000. So is the answer $500 or $30,000, if you know what I mean? Somewhere in between there is the price of it. Glenn, I know you've got a relatively stiff requirement for uninterruptible power in your house. I know you had another couple of comments on the original subject, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2J has a good comment.
We're going to give you right after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. And, Rich, I'm glad you're a very satisfied customer. Actually, I was involved in the design and the implementation of that system that was in North Shore University on that whole campus, that power system. And I'm glad to hear that the power was completely uninterrupted and you didn't even notice the difference. It's a beautiful thing. And as far as, Rich, having a system that's 200 amp service to your house that could be directly connected to your service, wired by a professional electrician that does have their license in Massapequa, you could have natural gas service connected, and it would cost you in total no more than $15,000. I would say you could probably get away with, depending on where the